So we're on class four of easy habits for happiness. We've kind of, the first half of the course sets the scene about, well, what is happiness? What are habits? How do they work? How do the negative ones work? How the positive ones work? And how do we purify the negative ones? And then for this next part of the course, we're going to dive in depth into the way that we think and feel, which is tonight, then the way that we communicate, how we speak, which is next week, and then how we act in the world, which is the final class. So we're kind of into the second part of the course. So it's going to be useful whether you're Buddhist or not, religious or not, because we're all people in the world, aren't we? So it's really handy information for us. So what we've covered so far, the kind of the approach that we can take, that the whole purpose of looking within our mind is worth it because we can actually cultivate a positive frame of mind. We can cultivate a sense of peace, satisfaction, contentment, happiness. It's something that we can actually grow within ourselves. We don't have to wait for it to happen to us or feel like we've got to get it from somewhere. So that really sets the scene that our mind. Also, how come this is possible? Because the nature of our mind is clear, is joyful. All of those good qualities of compassion and kindness are there deep within the core of our being. And there's just things that hamper them coming out. They're like the clouds. They're all of our fears and worries and disturbing emotions. And they are, even though the disturbing emotions are propelled by afflicted states of mind, mistakes, untamed emotions, thoughts, feelings, what propels them and continues them is that they become a habit. They gain their own momentum. And anything that we just leave to be a habit just gets bigger. So we've had a look at how to dismantle the negative habits, not by force, but by undoing them. So it's a very effective way to stop those negative habits even arising in the first place. And then we've also looked at the four opponent powers, which is the meditation of how to put it all into practice, how to purify mistakes, so that even though we can't undo time, undo what we've done, we can purify that component in our mind that experiences the suffering and that creates negativity. And we had reflection sheets last week and a meditation. So I'm just wondering, did anyone do that meditation? It would have been in your notes. It was just a one-pager on the Shakyamuni Buddha meditation. We did it at the end of the class and chanted the mantra. Did anyone have a go? Did you have a go? No? Nobody else?
I don't have the notes, so I didn't know what was in them, but that's okay. I did do the purifications. I made sure I did Vajrasattva purifications.
Yeah, so Vajrasattva purification is exactly the same. Well, it's not exactly the same, but it's a similar process of going through an internal experience of change. And that's the whole point, folks, of doing this meditation, is it's not enough just to know or to understand. We actually have to change how we feel, as you would know, because that's our bottom line, isn't it? How we feel about ourselves and the world. So that's where the meditation comes in. It makes us feel better, as well as working on a very deep level of changing our mind, our experience. So don't worry, we will have time to do another meditation tonight, and you can have a go, and I'll encourage you to do the meditation next week. I'd like to start also with a quote from the Buddha, from Lord Buddha. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. There's so much in this quote. The mind, it's the source of everything. Our mind is the source of everything, all of our experiences, everything that happens to us, everything that we think and feel, how we react to the world. So with our mental activity, largely kind of goes on unaware to ourselves. We don't even know we have mental activity. We just think it's us, for one thing. What happens with negative mental activity or destructive thoughts is they kind of burn their own track, don't they? And we start going around and around and we start dwelling on them. And then they can come to fruition. So one way is where we dwell on the negativity, say we don't like somebody, and then it culminates in us actually doing something nasty to them. Or we dwell on something that we really want. We get obsessed with something until eventually we just give in and we go and try and buy it or take it or get it. We can also dwell on anxieties and resentments. And then they develop their own momentum in our mind. It becomes really quite toxic. We don't like being with ourselves. It's like we have a civil war. And then, of course, this affects everything that we do and say. It colors everything that we do and say, how we talk to others, how we hear others, what we hear. And then, you know, it's compounded. So if we're in a really negative frame of mind, we just hear the negative things and then we respond just to the negative things. What do you think is going to come back at us? So right there in that split second, we've set up this terrible momentum. And then it runs away with us. And in the end, actually very quickly, this determines what our life is like and what kind of person we are. So the Buddha said that actually the body and the speech are servants of the mind. And how we think and how we act and how we speak is a result of the mind. It also determines the kind of person that we become. So if we want to change, if we want to be liked, if we want to be a good person, if we want to be happy, if we want to make something our life, all of these things, just trying to act it out isn't enough, or just trying to put in nice positive affirmations isn't enough. We actually have to change our mind, because otherwise we'll try really hard to be a good person, act all patient and all that. But the moment we get tired or stressed or too much happens too quickly, all of that effort is lost if we haven't changed our mind. So we can change, but it's quite unstable and we often revert back to our bad habits, and often quite challenging situations can bring out the worst in people rather than the best in people. So we want situations to bring out the best in us, not the worst in us. So how do we do that? We have to start by working on the mind. So changing our mind means becoming aware of what's happening in it. Checking up, Lama Yeshe often said, using our innate human intelligence then to respond to situations, external situations, and our own internal feelings. But starting by just becoming aware of what's going on. And, you know, Tamara, kind of following on to what we were just talking about before the class started, you might find that as you start delving in, it seems like everything's getting worse, but it's not. It's just that we're bringing our focus to it. All of that muck and mess and everything, it's been there the whole time. So please don't get disconsolate about it. Kind of it's better to actually have a look and see what's there and just go, well, wow, how amazing I've been able to get this far despite all of that mess inside. It's better to know about it because then we can do something about it. So just learning to become aware of what's going on is half the battle. So with that, let's do our little meditation to get started, to set our focus, our motivation. So where you are at home, try and get comfortable. Try and have your back fairly straight, but we're striking a nice balance between putting some effort into keeping our spine upright and our back straight and also being comfortable. One very nice way to do this is to imagine a thread of light running through your spine, just in front of the spine, and feel this thread coming out the crown of your head, this beam of light, as if you're being suspended from your crown. Your posture will naturally align. Once you feel that the weight of your body is supported like that, then let your shoulders drop. Let your shoulders become even. Even make sure you pull them back a little bit so the whole heart and chest area opens up, isn't all crouched over. Just have your hands resting gently in your lap or on your knees. Feel the stability of your posture. Feel how you're supported by the seat. Feel as if each vertebrae of your spine, one on top of the other, each one supporting the one above it. And release the various thoughts and memories of the day or what's happening next, and just bring your focus to the rising and falling of the breath. Just gently keep your awareness there on the breath, about 80% of your attention, 80% of effort. Just keeping your focus on the breath, 20% relaxing. And as you are bringing your attention to the breath, you may find that it wanders off. So that's natural, but do try and notice as soon as possible. And without getting involved in what you wandered off to, just notice and name. So it might be a memory that arises. Name it as a memory. Let it go and bring your focus back to the breath. It might be a worry. Again, name it. It's a worry. Don't get involved in the contents. Bring it back to the breath. It might be something in the future you're looking forward to. Again, name it. Anticipation or a feeling or a thought, and bring your focus back to the breath. So you have this experience of noticing if you've fallen off the breath, noticing what it was, and then bringing your focus back again. If the feelings arise of something, you know, pleasant, or if you're feeling naturally buoyant or happy, then try and just experience those feelings without wanting more, without diving into them. Just let them be and keep your main focus just on the breath. Or if the distractions are more of a tone that you don't like, again, without panicking, without trying to push them away, just naming them and bringing your focus back to the breath, because you're not reducible to any one thought or feeling. They're not you. Let go of the storyline or the contents. And instead, anchor your mind to the breath. and try and feel the spaciousness of the mind in which everything can arise and can fall away. And from this sense of spaciousness, then we can set our motivation for tonight. So on a most immediate level, we're looking at the workings of our mind and our mental attitudes. So what mental attitudes, frames of mind, or habits do you have that you want to stop? The ones that you've identified that are destructive, that make you unhappy, or that harm others. What mental habits or attitudes would you like to stop? And then what inner qualities would you like to develop? What qualities would you like to cultivate in your mind? Qualities that you might really admire in others and think, wow, I wish I was like that. So what are some of those qualities that you'd like to cultivate, to develop till they became automatic in your own mind? And then recognizing how, if we could let go of the negative habits, develop those positive qualities, how our own life would completely change, our attitude would change, how we interact with everyone would change. So setting our motivation, not only would that be good now immediately, but may this be the start of real lasting change. May we be able to bring forth every single one of our positive qualities and help every single person and being we come into contact with. And ultimately achieve liberation or enlightenment and be able to help all living beings by starting right now here. So with this motivation, you can bring your focus back to the room. Now we've got the big picture, why we're here. Let's delve in. So how to keep yourself nice. So I think this is an Australian saying. I'm not sure. Keep yourself nice. How to, be a good person and make the most of our life without putting any limits on it. And how we do that is by developing our ethics. So ethics are, from a Buddhist point of view, they're actually universal values. Ethics are a system like these road signs that keep us safe as we're barreling through life. So Buddhist ethics aren't just rules that are made up, but they're a set of suggestions that can really help us. And they're based on recognizing how we're interdependent, how we interrelate with everybody and everything in the world. So I take a lot of heart from this because I don't like being told what to do. And I certainly don't like people telling me this is good and this is bad, because I want to say, well, why? You convince me. So the idea that Buddhist ethics come from really, really seeing how we are interrelated, how what we do affects the world, it affects others, and it affects us. And other living beings have feelings just like we do. Therefore, they matter just like we do. So they matter to themselves as much as we matter to ourselves. So we need to look after everybody because they are just like us. Any Buddhist practices are based on this, are based on a system of ethics, of real understanding of our own nature and how we are in the world and how we're interdependent, how everything that we do, whether we're aware of it or not, has consequences. And that if we're not aware of it, can lead to a whole lot of disastrous outcomes that we didn't plan, but nevertheless come upon us, like, you know, climate change or pollution or toxic workplace culture. But also, if we can recognize interdependence and how we have power in the world, how what we do does have an effect, then we can harness that and we can really change things around. So Buddhist ethics are a set of universal values. Doesn't mean that you need to believe in anything or even be religious. And what they're based on is a strategy of avoiding the most harmful activities that we can do, the things that harm people the most. That's where we start avoiding those. So those road signs are like telling us, oh, when you get into this situation, be really careful. Go slow around this bend. And actually in this situation, stop. And that way we keep ourselves safe, we keep others safe. The system of Buddhist ethics, I mean, it's a huge section of the teachings, but for us, where do we get started? Something really easy and palatable are what are called the three doors of activities, or the three pathways of activity. So our physical actions, our body, what we do with our body, how we physically act in the world, our speech, how we communicate with others, and our mind, our thoughts, feelings, attitudes, all the internal activity that, like that quote said, is the boss of the other two. We want to know what the most non-virtuous or negative actions are and really avoid those, just like the road signs. We've got to know where the danger points are. And then, if possible, we can start developing our positive actions, positive ways of speaking, positive ways of acting. So we've got to do it in that order. We've got to abandon the negativity first and then practice the positive. Just like when you're driving, you've got to actually abide by the road rules. That's the minimum. And then you can learn really good defensive driving. You can get your driving skills up. I like this analogy of the road signs because in a way we're like drunk drivers with life, where what are we drunk under? What are we driving under the influence of? Our afflictive states of mind, our disturbing emotions, our fears and our hopes and our worries and our dreams and our emotional baggage and all of that is the driver, and we're driving under that influence. So we've got to really keep ourselves nice so that we don't make things worse, and then we can start actually making things better. So for today, we're going to look at the mind, the three main negative activities of the mind, the ones that are the most destructive, and what we can do in their place. And then for the next couple of weeks, we'll look at the speech. What are the most destructive ones and what can we do instead? So we're not just leaving a vacuum there. Are there any questions or comments before we dive in? Anything at all? You know, you're allowed to ask questions.
I think these sorts of things are, I think was one of the exercises last week to try and keep positive states of mind for a day, 2 days, 3 days.
Yeah.
So I found that quite easy while I wasn't going anywhere or seeing anybody. It was so easy to be so positive and just be really at peace. But then it's almost like you're in a cocoon. So when you go out, it's like this overstimulation of all your senses, and you feel like you're on guard so much. So yeah, it was really interesting.
Delma, and also that has been exacerbated by COVID because, you know, we have been in our cocoon, and when we're in our cocoon, we kind of feel, you know, fairly okay and strong, and we let our guard down. And then we go out into the world and we're all disjointed and we don't know how to communicate with people and things come out wrong and we're really sensitive. Like someone says something that's just normal and we're like, oh, crying. And, you know, And think, where did that come from? How come? But it's because we forget. We get so used to being in our own little bubble, letting our guard down, and not being quite strong enough or practiced enough that it's coming easily. So then we go out and we've just underestimated the strength of being out in the world, the effect it has on us. It's taken us by surprise. And, I mean, this is so that they've even got ads on the telly. You know, they just had a spate of ads on the TV. It was kind of like a joke. People go into the bar and they're having their first drinks at the bar and they clink their drinks to say cheers and they break the glass and everybody gets all embarrassed. And the little quote is like, oh, you know, how do we do it? Or it's okay to be a bit disjointed or whatever it is. And then there's something else where people go to shake hands or not shake hands and it's like, and then everyone goes red and embarrassed and it's okay to not know. So they've done an ad campaign about this. So we're not alone, Delma. this is actually what happens. And when we're doing the internal work, yeah, it's going to be a bit disjointed when we go out into the world. So that's another reason to do the meditation practice and keep doing that reflection to build up our muscles and our fortitude. So it's much easier to draw on in the heat of the moment, because normally when we're out in the world, we just forget everything. We've got to be able to reach back and draw on that inner work that we've been doing already. So thank you, Delma. So our mental non-virtuous actions.
Sorry, Miffy, I think Tamara had
Tamara, yes. Sorry, did you have something? Hang on a sec. Oh, yeah, go for it.
Oh, it was just a little nothing. Well, I was happy to let it go, but I just wanted to say, you know, just a few steps back, you were talking about how when you kind of start doing this, hang on, my cat's ripping paper. when you kind of start doing this stuff, I also really noticed so much. You know, I'm sitting there doing some setting my motivations for the day or whatever, and doing, you know, taking refuge and all those things. And then I noticed straight away when I go somewhere, it's like, oh my God, I'm so impatient. oh my God, I'm a monster. You know, like it's so clear. And sometimes I cry because it's quite awful.
Oh, I hear you. And I think a few of us hear you, Tamara. Yep, I absolutely understand. And exactly the same thing. So, but that is already quite extraordinary because there is your awareness, that's mindfulness there, going, oh my gosh, what's happening? And being aware of it. So most times we're not aware of it, we're just going along. So it's a very good sign to be aware of it. And then if with our habits we can put in place 1, 2, 3, what do we do then so that we don't let rip with our impatience, but we have something to do instead? Mm-hmm. So that's what these habits are about, so that we've got something to go to fall back on, so that even though our mind might be going, we can trust ourselves to not say anything bad or to not retaliate. And, you know, then it makes the world a better place. But why we're starting tonight with our mind is that if we don't work on our mind first, just watching our speech or just watching our retaliation, it's not enough. It'll never be enough. We'll always bust out and, you know, disappoint ourselves. So we're starting on the hard one. But, yeah, that's a really good context. Tomorrow.
I think the other thing is too, when we do, like Tamara said, when you actually recognize and you think, oh my God, I'm a monster, but then there's that habitual thought that we try and blame somebody else. It's somebody else's fault that I feel like this. They've made me feel like that.
Oh, that's yes.
Habitual.
I'm a monster and it's your fault. Yes, because we don't like to carry the responsibility. And that's because we think we are the monster and we don't want to be. So it's because we are identifying with our destructive habit patterns as being us. So if we look at our body and our speech, what we do and how we communicate, they're both servants of the mind. The mind is driving it. Whether we know it or not, the mind is driving it. If we just change our physical habits but not our mind, our progress won't last. If we just change our how we communicate, try and be nice to everybody, and we don't change our mind, it's not going to last. So the mental actions, it's a bit tricky to figure out, well, what's a mental activity? But what it is, it means basically dwelling on something that's really negative or a negative frame of mind. And by dwelling on it, it strengthens it. Another way to think of a mental action is an intended thought. So we actually dive into that thought and make it bigger, make it more familiar to us. And the worst ones, the most destructive out of all of the different things that our mind can do are the three: covetousness, ill will, and mistaken views. So covetousness, that always being dissatisfied, always wanting something, looking what other people have and wanting what they have, that state of mind, when we dwell on it, it can't help but reach its culmination, which is when we go and try and get the thing, where we have the affair, where we steal the thing, or we, you know, get it through nefarious means, or we commit fraud or whatever it is. It just gets the better of us, and it comes from dwelling on it. Or we can get really resentful about other people that have the things that we want. So ill will, when we dwell on our resentments, when we dwell on our blame, ends up in really ill will or malice ends up in really violent actions. So violent actions don't come from nowhere. They come from the mind dwelling and ruminating on resentments and blame and all those, revenge. And they can result in people murdering each other, in domestic violence. So, again, it's a natural culmination of dwelling on those negativities. And where both of those come from is mistaken views or confusion. So that we have confusion and mistaken views, and then we dwell on those and we make them really concrete. So the most coarse examples of that is things like racism, bigotry, that kind of thing. But the result of that is that we start being really alienated and really aggressive, intimidated by others, feeling very alone. We end up shutting people out, losing our enthusiasm for life, feeling really jaded and burnt out. So these three negative habit patterns or negative activities that we do with our mind, they have a huge effect on us. And then they affect all of those other habits as well, like habitual blame or habitual dissatisfaction. So what I thought to do was to actually start with some just general habit patterns and see if you recognize any of them. We're going to have a look at the destructive ones, get the depressing bit done and dusted, and then we're going to look at some positive habit patterns and see if you recognize any of those just in general, because, you know, really we're never short of the negative habit patterns, are we? So the destructive ones: a habit of nervousness, worry, anxiety, that's also can manifest as restlessness. So I have quite a habit of this, of having that feeling of dread in my stomach, you know. But if I fall into it, Or if I go, no, I don't want it, it just makes it bigger and it becomes a habitual kind of worry or experience. So whether we're fighting against it or whether we're falling into it and elaborating on it, both ways, we're engaging. It becomes a habit. It becomes familiar to us. The other one, depression, avoiding important aspects of your life, la, 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 not listening, you know, feeling quite defeatist, like, oh, it'll never work, I'll never be any good. So really quite down on ourselves. That in itself can become a default way of being, you know, and these two things, we'd probably never talk to other people like that, but we talk to ourselves like this. We may have fits of rage, dwell on revenge, have violent fantasies, be very prejudiced, bigotry, all of those things where a lot of this we see on the news, like a lot of the domestic terrorism comes from just dwelling on rage or revenge or violent fantasies. And Delma, very astute of you to say a lot of this comes from blaming the other for our own unhappiness. And so then, of course, we go into this, it becomes a cycle, and in the end, it ends up in things like, you know, terrorism or domestic terrorism or domestic violence. Overthinking things, panicked distraction, obsessions, obsessive compulsions, where our intelligence and our sense of detail runs rampant and we can't control it. And it's just, it results in panic rather than wisdom. It runs us, we don't run it. Being confused as to what's right or wrong. So having a shifting morality based on self-interest. So a lot of our politicians do that. They'll say one thing when it's in their interests and then, whoa, next week it's a whole other thing. It's very unmoored, isn't it? But we too can do that if we're frightened, if we're craving, if we're just, you know, looking out for me, number one, self-interest. And then habit of dissatisfaction, wanting more, never being happy with what we have, always feeling there is a lack. So perhaps at this stage I should say, is there anything that doesn't resonate with you? Does any of it resonate with you? Anything jump out at you of those negative ones?
Some more than others. Yeah.
Yeah, so we'd probably be you know, susceptible to some more than others. And so these are all kind of general expressions of some of the, like, these three most negative ones that we'll have a look at and what we can do instead. So then the positive side of things. Now, here are some positive mental habits. And you might draw a blank as to, well, what are positive mental habits? But a lot of them, I've got to say, are based in cliches. They're real cliches, but actually cliches are there because they are based in something quite profound. So for instance, you know, when people say, oh, you know, if you walk a mile in their shoes, that one in particular I love. There is actually a walk that they did in Sydney where I can't remember if it was for women's rights or something like that, but all the blokes, everybody's husbands, all put on high heels and just walked 1 kilometer through the CBD. And, you know, by the end of that, no one had to think about empathy. Everyone was just naturally going, oh, my God, how do you women do it in your high heels and keep sane and not, like, just lash out at everybody or whatever, like, just real genuine empathy. So it's true, it's such a skillful thing. Walk a mile in someone's shoes, just a little bit, and you get a real feel for it. So I mean, you could do this too with, like, borrow someone's baby for an hour, and look after it. And you know, that can cure a whole lot of people wanting children right there. So if we don't walk a mile in someone's shoes, of course, then we don't have empathy or patience. But if we do walk a mile in someone's shoes, then naturally we have patience and empathy. It's not something that we have to drag up. So as a positive habit, this one of just putting ourselves in someone's shoes is so effective. Here's another one. I love this one, even though it's a Christian one. There, for the grace of God, go I. So this one, it's, you know, it helps you with humility, where you just think, well, you know, if I was in that same situation, I probably would have lost it. I probably would have responded much worse than how they are. So this way we naturally develop a sense of humility and respect for others. It's a great mental activity to have. Looking for the silver lining, the opportunity in any situation. Now, this one, unfortunately, is often the strongest kind of habit when it comes to profit. You know, great entrepreneurs and business people, they look at, well, where is everything failing, and everyone thinks it's a problem, and they find the silver lining and they make pots of money. So there's a big incentive there with money making, but we can do this with everything, especially with our problems. So, you know, even when we're looking at what's going on in our mind, and we may be quite dismayed, there is a silver lining to that, and that is, if we have the courage to look, then we'll have the courage to help others who are going through the same thing. And, of course, the biggest silver lining is, even though COVID has, you know, destroyed the world and put a stop to, you know, so many people's lives and really such an upheaval for all young people coming through, the silver lining for the Dharma centres is that people who can't travel at night or can't get to the centre now can finally come to class. And now we have classes all over the world, and we can go to classes all over the world. It's like this Dharma celebration, this festival that's happened because of it. And it's not just our centre, but it's Buddhist centres across the board in all traditions. And possibly, I think, other religions as well. It's been really extraordinary for spiritual growth and creating community. So that's a positive habit to have. Look for the silver lining. Here's a couple of sayings that we can develop when things go wrong. Instead of going, oh, no, how fascinating. And the other one, when things break, instead of saying, oh, no, of course. So those two, as a habit, they're brilliant. So the how fascinating one comes from a great conductor, Benjamin Zander, and he held this summer school for musical protégés, and they'd be playing music and symphony this and that and whatever, and they're practicing, and he goes, stop. You know, something's gone wrong over there or not. And what do we say? And the whole orchestra would go, how fascinating. So they just felt okay about making a mistake. It's not a value judgment. You're not, you know, bad. Any mistake is fascinating. So it's a great one to put in there. And the other one of course, if anything goes wrong or anything breaks, especially if you smash something in the kitchen by accident, the cup falls, whatever, the handle falls off, you train yourself to say, of course, because it's the only possible end to anything that's crockery, for instance, is broken. There's no other possible end for it. It's just a matter of when. So we've got at Langley Tampa Centre, we have I think it's like a dessert tureen from 1850, and we had our biscuits in it. You know, it's an antique. It was my mother's. It was, you know, her mother's before her. And we've just always put our biscuits in it and put the biscuits out. So I'm waiting for the day that it breaks and I can go, of course. But because if we don't, then, of course, we get really attached and then we don't use it at all. So what's the point of that? So a couple of really positive mental habits. In an argument, give the other the victory rather than win the expense at the expense of the relationship. So this is in Geshe Langri Tangpa's 8 verses, but this is also something that in one of those ABC shows of the agony aunts, you know, they got all those fantastic comedians and kind of famous Australians to talk about the agony of growing up or the agony of marriage, the agony of Christmas parties. And so one of them, the guys were saying in the agony of relationships was, don't just try and win the argument because you want to win. Just give them the victory because otherwise it's going to be at the expense of your relationship. And I, you know, so that's a universal understanding. Pay it forward. Any good deed that's shown to you, try and show it to the next person. Celebrate milestones, important events, celebrate them. Bring your attention to them. Make a big deal of them. Because we bring our attention to the disasters, but we have to bring our attention to the really good things too. And, of course, you can't go past a good gratitude journal. So are there any of those that you like the idea of that stood out for you, the positive ones?
Let them win the argument. I like that one.
Good on you. Good on you, Therese. Yes. Yeah, and it's so skillful because, you know, it shows you're listening, you're respecting them, and actually it's the long game because you may actually win later on, but actually through communicating and sharing, not through just the force of winning the argument. But gee whiz, I'm happy to hear that you like that because I'm really hopeless at that one. It's hard. It's a big ask.
I don't have the energy to argue.
Excellent. There is a silver lining right there. if you've got limited energy, if you've got no energy, that can actually mean that you really economize and you just put it into what's important. So let's have a look then at these three, the non-virtuous actions. So non-virtuous means they bring suffering. It's not just a moralistic thing. It's just the result is suffering for ourselves and others. So out of the three worst, most destructive mental attitudes or habits, here's one of them. And so what we're going to try and do is avoid covetousness. So what is covetousness? How do we even know if we have it? So I've put up here the symptoms. We know we are dominated by covetousness if our personality is dominated by desire. If we're always craving things, if we're always thinking about what we don't have and what we want. So we're not enjoying what we have. We have no contentment, no sense of contentment. On a more subtle level, we know we have covetousness because our inner experience is that all the things that we have seem to just break or wear out or degenerate or get ugly. They just don't seem nice anymore. So it's like it's not actually those things, but it's our sense of satisfaction or contentment deteriorates. And we obviously know that we have covetousness if we actually act it out, if we actually have the affair, actually commit fraud, actually overspend on our lay-bys or afterpay, actually, you know, act out the hoarding tendencies and start being unable to move through all the stuff in our house. So they're all symptoms of having covetousness as a frame of mind, and you can already see it's like an internal bully. So what to do isn't just to try and get more and better stuff, which may be our first response. Actually, what to abandon is to start seeing the faults of desire, to start seeing the faults of craving, the faults of having a discontented mind, rather than the faults of our stuff. And how we do that is by recognizing that the object, those things, those people, that perfect job, they're not the source of our happiness. The source of our happiness is a sense of contentment, is our capacity for happiness, not those things. The happiness isn't in the things. So also seeing how the faults of desire, it's like drinking salt water. The more we have, the more we get, the more we want, the more discontent we are, the more we have to have. It's never enough. You know, is there any millionaire in the world that's gone, that's enough? I have enough. It's really rare. It's so rare. How we actually can abandon attachment is by, and you'll remember on that first class when we talked about the types of happiness, is by focusing on the deeper states of happiness. So not the happiness that comes from collecting stuff of what we get from the world, experiences, people, things, but that the deeper states of happiness that comes from sharing, from contributing. And immediately our real pressing sense of craving and desire and covetousness will subside. And one that I find quite confronting, just stop thinking about other people's wealth or your own and how you want more. Just to put a stop to it. It's like the stop sign going, I'm not going there anymore. It's just making things worse. So they're the things that we really must abandon if we want to be free of covetousness, this state of mind. And what do we practice? This is the main bit, rejoicing at other people's fortune. So when things go well for other people, thinking, I'm so happy for them. I'm really glad. If someone else wins the tournament, wins the medal, gets the promotion at work, then think, well, I'm happy for them. At least someone got it. Rather than going, oh, you know, what about me? So if we didn't get it, okay, we've got to cut our losses. But then actually practice thinking, well, just as it's important to me, it's important to them. So at least someone has it. I'm really happy for them. Practice being content. So being content is something we can get used to practicing. It doesn't necessarily come naturally. Of what we have is enough. And that's quite a good mental trick to think, oh yeah, well, what I have, it's not perfect, but it's enough. And of course, nothing in samsara is perfect. Striving for perfection from out there, it's not possible. So then we can go, yeah, okay, so this is what I do to kind of take the pressure off. Yeah, what I have, it's not the exact perfect thing that I want, but it's okay. And, you know, I've heard this is also something that you can do, say, as a parent, the good enough parent, instead of trying to be perfect, to be the good enough parent. You're doing the best that you can. Of course, it's not perfect, but it's okay. So it really takes the pressure off. Recognizing the object is not the source of your happiness. And remembering the deeper states of happiness. So we can use our wisdom in this, and it is very effective. Rather than to say to yourself, no, 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 you can't have those things, kind of, you know, forcing against covetousness doesn't quite work. We've got to look at something that actually brings a sense of satisfaction. And that's those deeper states of happiness that come from contributing what we give to the world rather than what we get from the world. It has a far longer sense of satisfaction. So this is the practices to do. And if we do them, the result, oh, wow, the result is you will easily accomplish whatever you wish for. So things will come easily. Things will happen easily. Things will come together harmoniously and well without much effort, without like feeling you're pushing everything uphill. So isn't that a wonderful result? And that's something we want to happen, but how on earth do we get there? Well, this is how we get there, through these practices. And the bumper sticker, what I have is good enough. That's our go-to phrase. You know, in the heat of the moment when we're feeling all covetous, we remember, oh, what I have is good enough. So as a place of where to get started with this mental kind of attitude, do you have any questions or comments for this one? Does it make sense? It's all okay?
It is really hard to feel happy for someone if you don't think they've deserved it.
Yes, that's right. So deserving is always a very short time span. It's usually just that few days or months. It's certainly not over years. You know, we don't know what's happened to the people in their life way back in time to make them what they are now. But from a Buddhist point of view, anything that happens is a result. It necessarily had a cause. And when things go right, karmically, the cause was because in the past, you helped things go right. You helped others. So I can look at someone like Donald Trump and go, you know, he doesn't deserve to have all that power, all that wealth. But actually, that's a result. And it's a result of in the past being so generous, being supporting so many people, that now he gets the result of you know, incredible power. And yet there's the tragedy. What's he doing with it? So that way you can stop your resentment. And then you can think, well, you know, just like I want wealth, like I think about this, you know, just like I want wealth, other people have wealth, at least someone has it. I'm happy for them. And I hope it brings them the satisfaction that I think it would bring me. The other thing, Therese, about whether people deserve it or not, it's what happens is we conflate what people do with the person. So if someone acts really badly, we think they're a bad person, but they're not. They're a person just like you and me. Their cat and dog know that. They're a person just like you and me. But we see what they're doing and we go, that is unacceptable. And so then we think the person is unacceptable. And this is how racism works. This is how bigotry works and prejudice works, that we think the person is unacceptable. So, you know, we can look at the person and go, actually, you know, they're just like me. They have hopes and wishes just like me, and they have fears just like me. So if something good happens to them, I'm happy for them. Really, really, really down to the basic human nature. But it takes a lot of practice.
maybe it's obvious, but it's kind of related to like envy, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. And so envy, again, we think that our happiness comes from the things. So we see someone that has what we want, we envy them. And then with the mind of covetousness, if we dwell on that, we'll end up trying to take that thing from them. Or even worse, destroy that thing that they have.
Mm.
So this comes from covetousness, and covetousness comes from this mistake of thinking that our happiness comes from the things, from the person, from out there. So that's why there's this multifaceted approach of what to practice, and we've got to do all of them. We've got to recognize that the object won't bring us happiness if we don't have that capacity for happiness in our heart. So we have to practice being content. We have to get good at being content. And then how to rejoice at others' fortune. We've got to start seeing how they're just like us. Underneath, they're just like us. So that does lead into ill will, because you'll see that, like, you know, envy and jealousy and revenge and spite, you know, they're all intertwined together, but they come from these three main mental attitudes that we're so familiar with. So the next one, ill will. So we've all probably got ill will towards someone or something. For me, it's often politicians. I've got to say they're my go-to example. But ill will, what we're looking at is not other people showing us ill will and malice. It's our own ill will. We're looking at how it's happening in us, in our mind. And, you know, there's... So someone say really angry or malicious to us, our normal response is to get angry and malicious back again. So that's where we're looking at our own response, what's happening in our mind. So we know we have ill will. How do we know? Because our mind is dominated by thoughts of revenge. And this can be very subtle. This can be that in an argument, you may not have said anything, but you go home and you play through your mind what you wished you had have said. That's a form of like practicing revenge. It's not acting it out, but it's there in the mind. So if you're dominated by these thoughts of revenge, you also know you have ill will on a more subtle level if you find yourself always without help. No one helps you. You feel set upon, abandoned. So we might think, oh, that's because no one's helping us. But actually, it's that we're blind to people helping us. We're not letting people help us. And that comes from this low, underground, low-level ill will on a very basic level. I don't like it. I don't want it. Kind of this sense of retaliation. So these symptoms, that's why I've called them symptoms, because they're indicators that something's wrong inside. And the inside of our mind is what we can do something about straight away. Also, if we find that we are living a life filled with conflict and fear, that is that the outward mirror of ill will within our own mind, or a predominance of hostility around us. So this is quite a tricky one to stomach, but we may have an external situation where there is a predominance of hostility, but whether that affects us, whether it sticks, whether it goes deep into us or not, that depends on us. Whether it's just water off a duck's back, whether our equilibrium is not disturbed, some people are like that, you know, they sail through. Why, for some of us, do we feel like there is this never-ending hostility? That's because all of that hostility is going all the way in and it's sticking to something in us. And what it's sticking to is our own propensity for ill will, malice, not liking people, wanting people to suffer. And what happens then? Then we lose all of our logic. We can't reason. We like hurting others. And then we may actually physically express it in violence.
So, Miffy, are you actually saying that predominance of hostility is surrounding us? It's almost like we attract that sort of person. Within our own circle of stuff, and then that is it's also because that's the type of personality we're exhibiting.
Yeah, so violence attracts violence. Violence elicits violence. So if other people are hostile to us, if we're not careful, we'll just be hostile back. We just throw it back again, and that creates more violence and a violent atmosphere. So then often we may not act on it, but it's still going around in our mind. So we've still got a violent atmosphere in our mind of retaliation, of sorting out the goodies from the baddies. These are the people I don't like and I'm happy when they suffer. These are the people I like and I'm willing to do anything, including negative things, to protect them. So it's a very hostile atmosphere and there's no equanimity there. So then that elicits even more of that. So this can be played out over a lot of time. So you might be changing now. You might be trying to be patient and kind and a good person, but there's this reverberation of focusing on the negativities and generating ill will towards others that is continuing on in the background. So it's quite tricky. We've got to be able to distinguish what is actually happening out there. It may actually be violent and hostile, and it may be very important to leave. But why it sticks, why it reverberates within us, why it has such an effect within us, that's on us. And it's not that we're bad, or it's not even that we're malicious. It's that that's the habit that we have is one of hostility. So that habit is not us. We're not a bad person, but we may have a habit of being really judgmental, really unforgiving, or really aggressive. It's a fine line, and also because, you know, in our culture there's a lot of victim blaming and things like that, so we've got to be careful with that. But really when it comes to it, why it sticks is our own propensity, and it's like an echo, and that is something we can do something about. So what do? The very, very minimum, we've got to abandon thoughts of harming others. So don't even indulge in them. And in fact, even if you watch lots of violent movies where the baddie gets their comeuppance, don't watch those movies, because that just exacerbates it, where you go, someone else is harmed and you go, good. So that's ill will and malice. So trying to not let yourself dwell on thoughts of the revenge or harming others. How? By recognizing that the hatred harms you, definitely. It may or may not harm them. We've got to see how this toxic inner environment is so destructive for us, those we love. How do we also stop thoughts of harming? So one of the things, I've got it up here in the practice, how to practice. So one, cultivating love and compassion for others. How do we do that? So how we cultivate a sense of kindness towards others, open-heartedness towards others, is by finding what we have in common. So one lady was telling me, you know, her husband had gone and had an affair with someone, ran off with them, and was divorcing her. She was really, really cross, and she was super cross at the other woman. But then when we started talking, it did become apparent that this other woman, she had a lot in common. So number one, they both liked the same bloke. They had the same taste in men. But also they're of the same era. They'd suffered the same amount of sexism at work. They both had teenage children that were rude to them, you know, so they have things in common. So now the thing where you put them as all bad as the enemy starts dissolving a little bit. And then you can have a sense of at least empathy, a little bit of kindness when you find what you've got in common. The biggest problem with that is that we don't want to have anything in common with Donald Trump. We've got a lot in common. The other thing that we don't like, having compassion for our enemies. And so this is one thing that, you know, with the angry people, the angry face. So what we see as anger and bad behavior and a malicious person and it's unacceptable, we just can't see below the surface. But the only reason anyone acts badly is through unhappiness or fear or, you know, mistaken ideas. No one ever acts badly from a sense of equanimity, equilibrium, compassion, kindness, a happy mind. No way. Open-heartedness. So guaranteed, anyone that shows us anger, violence, aggression, underneath, they are hurting. It's really hard to see. And they may not even see it. They may be just identifying with their power and their aggression. They don't want to know about their hurt. But we can see it and we can hold that in our heart and we can feel compassion for them. Just like a brutalized guard dog, you know, we're very, very careful, but we don't hate them. We just see with, you know, compassion, wow, look what's happened to them and what they've become.
I think a really good example of that, Miffy, is the Dalai Lama and his attitude to the Chinese invading Tibet. You know, he doesn't hold any hatred and he asks others not to hold any hatred for them. And yet
you can't
see any benefit of what a country invading a peaceful country, what possible good could that, the, you know, the powers have in mind? You just can't see it, can you?
And he's so very careful about that too, because he says when the Chinese army invaded. So he doesn't even go, like, we go straight to the people, oh, the Chinese, but no, it's the Chinese army. And so within that, there's probably people that are conscripted. It's their only way to make a living. They're there, they're in some, you know, outpost in godforsaken middle of nowhere, all of this kind of thing. So it just changes, even with his speech, it changes. But that's how we do it, by actually finding what we've got in common. So, and he does that all the time. He wants the welfare of the Chinese people and the welfare of the Tibetans. So what an amazing role model. We can be like the Dalai Lama. And if you're going to hate anything, hate the behavior, but not the person. The moment you start not feeling concern for the person, you know you've gone too far. So all of this, it's going to help society, it's going to help others, but mostly the very first benefit is it's going to help us. It's in our very best interests to let go of ill will and malice, especially to the harmers, to those really destructive people. So it doesn't mean that we become an apologist and we agree with everything that they do. Doesn't mean that we stop being careful, but it means we stop hating. And it's only if we stop hating and open our heart, is there any way that we can fix the situation? It can never be fixed by hatred or violence. Maybe in the short term it can be slowed down or stopped, but after it, it's actually worse. And anybody who's been through a war will tell you this. The result, if we abandon ill will, if we abandon malice, we become fearless and we naturally have a sense of great confidence. So this is, we all want to feel confident, don't we? We all want to be free of our anxieties. We want to be fearless. And so we try usually just to give ourselves a pep talk to do it. But actually, if we want to be confident, to not be shy, to be able to stand up for what's important, to stand up to bullies, we have to do it being free of ill will. We remove that ill will and malice and sense of revenge and hatred from our heart, then naturally we'll become fearless, we'll have confidence. So this gives me a lot of hope. The bumper sticker is, just like me, they too want to be happy. So this is important. It's not just, yeah, everybody wants to be happy. You've got to preface it with, just like me. They're just like Donald Trump, just like me, wants to be happy. And those right-wing domestic terrorists, you know, that go and bomb mosques and things like that, just like me, they want to be happy, but they're going about in this terrible way. And if we can start understanding what's got them to that state where they have dwelt so much on the negativity and malice and revenge and everything, that they actually go out and commit those acts of violence. If we want to stop that, we have to understand how it started. just force back on it again, it's not enough. It won't actually stop it. So at the very, 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 very least, just like the guard dog, just like me, wants to be safe, wants to be happy. That's the starting point, and that's realistic. So the bumper stickers get more difficult as we go on tonight, folks, because the third bumper sticker is even more challenging. And that's to do with this third one, the third mental activity that's really destructive, mistaken views, dwelling on mistaken views or distorted views. And how do we even know that we have them? Well, basically, if we suffer, we've got them. If we have unhappiness, it's because we're out of kilter with reality, we've got mistaken views. But mistaken views are ones that we then dwell on and start justifying. So it's like a double whammy. Not only are we confused and mistaken, but then we dwell on them. How do we know we have them? Our mind is dominated by confusion. So this really resonates with me because, you know, I don't know what to do here, what to do there. Is it this or is that? I don't know what to do. What's it about? What's happening? All of that confusion, that's a symptom of having mistaken views. And remember, mistaken or distorted, that also means we can do something about it. But fundamentalism also is a mistaken view. And why? Because it's out of step with reality and it creates harm. It harms others. It can't be right. We also know we have mistaken views if we feel cynical, bored, a bit jaded, a bit stuck. And if our experience is that we have no protection from events or from problems, we feel it all coming down upon us. We feel isolated. So this is quite broad, isn't it? This is almost, you could say, you know, the human condition being filled with angst. But actually it's quite specific. It comes from having mistaken views and dwelling within those mistaken views and not knowing. So how do we get at this? What we have to abandon is feelings of indifference towards others on the more subtle level, or feelings of prejudice or partiality. So for us, it's very easy to care about the nice people and very difficult to care about the troublemakers. They're much more challenging to care about. So right there, there's partiality. And that's where family conflicts come from. That's where wars between countries come from. And then we exacerbate it by justifying it with prejudicial views. We have an urge to kind of sort people out into the ones we like, the ones we don't like. We judge them. Therefore, they're good people and they're bad people. So we have a lot of favoritism going on and a lot of prejudice. So from our side, we've got to try and abandon that. That kind of sorting out, especially the ones that we think don't matter or we don't want to deal with. And on generally just that indifference that we have to others. So I found COVID a real wake-up call for this indifference, because everybody was saying, remember at the beginning, you know, in these unprecedented times, over and over, like it was this really big deal. You know, COVID and lockdown, and you don't know what's going to happen and how you get it, and it's before anybody kind of knew much about the virus. And I actually found it was only unprecedented to me. Actually, within living memory, there was something very similar that happened, which was the whole AIDS, HIV that happened in the 80s. That's within living memory. And it was far worse because there was the stigma on top of it, of being hunted down in the street, of being locked up because in Tasmania it was still illegal and you could go to prison for being gay. So this is not unprecedented. It's in living memory. But the whole reason everyone says it is because it hadn't happened to me, you know, to ourselves. So it's only when a disaster happens to us that we actually become aware that it's ever happened to anybody else, that it actually matters. And the whole rest of the time, there's been plagues coming and going in history. Yeah, whatever, that's just happening over there to those other people. So this really shocked me, this kind of indifference that I didn't know I had. And same thing, you know, we're not aware of, say, domestic violence till it happens to us or someone close to us. Or we're not aware of the plight of refugees until we know one. And the rest of the time, we just don't care. So that's a very subtle level of mistaken views, and it leads to indifference towards others. And indifference leads to harming others. So that's what we've got to abandon, that sense of not caring about other people. How do we do it? Well, really nice ways. Just inquire after others. How are you? But not just that, a little bit more, like actually become curious about people. You know what? Anything surprising happened to you in the last week? Or even just finding out a little bit more about people without being too confrontational, like what's your favorite movie this year? Or what's a really good book that you just read? So becoming, once you become curious about people, they start becoming real people. They mean something to us. They start, it's, you know, people start to matter to us. So it's really nice developing this sense of being curious about others and having some nice kind of conversational openers to find out about others. Embracing other cultures, and a great way to do that is just to go and learn to cook food from other cultures. It's a great way to just find out, you know, bond with others, make friends with others. Learning new skills, learning an instrument, joining a choir, all of those really nice things to do is actually a way to start working against mistaken views, indifference, and prejudice. And the result, well, whatever we study, whatever we learn, will actually open our heart, will make us a better human being. So we won't become more jaded and cynical. We'll actually start feeling better about ourselves and the world. So, again, we can kind of figure out, okay, if I've been studying and learning about the world and about myself and everything, and I'm just feeling worse and worse about it, more and more tight, more and more skeptical, demoralized, then we know it's, we still got mistaken views. Because if we're free of mistaken views, then everything that we learn will open our heart and make us a better person. So the bumper sticker for this one, how things appear is not how they actually are. So this is the go-to. It's just like with the angry face. It looks like an angry person, but actually it's an upset person.
What's the bumper sticker for covetousness?
For covetousness, what I have is good enough.
Thank you.
So, you know, the thing, how things appear is not how they are. One way that we can approach that is just to think of ourselves as beginners. I find that it's so good to think of myself as a beginner. I'm allowed to not know stuff. It's okay. It's not a reflection on my personality. I'm not a loser. I just don't know stuff. I'm a beginner. So it takes the pressure off and it makes it easier to be open-minded. And then whatever happens, how we first think what's happening, we just say to ourselves, it's not the whole story. There's more to this than what meets the eye. So if we can get going on these, and this is why I've put the bumper stickers there, so it's our go-to to help remind us, then the take-home points. All that we are is a result of all that we have thought. It's how we frame the world with our thoughts. And these three destructive ways of thinking, they really color our world. So on one hand, don't believe everything that you think. You're not your brain. So we might think this and that and have all sorts of opinions and ideas and whatever. We may get tunnel vision. We may have misconceptions about things. We might have assumptions about things. Anything like hopes and fears and worries, they're all things that we think, but we're not our brain. That's just the baggage that we're carrying along. And at the same time, don't believe everything that you feel, because feelings are not facts. So we might feel scared, or we might feel down, or we might feel that we're no good. And that's a big feeling, but it's actually not true. It's not a fact. So we have to have this nuanced kind of approach where we acknowledge all of those enormous feelings, especially when we're going out and, you know, we're getting all impatient with people and then we're getting all upset. Acknowledge those feelings, but don't believe the story they're telling you. There's going to be a whole big story that goes along with it. None of that's true. It's all tainted by these misconceptions and by our emotions. So we've got to acknowledge the emotions are there, but don't believe the story they're telling you. And remember, there's no absolute right way to look at a situation. So it's best to focus on the most beneficial view for everybody. So that's the thing. How things appear isn't exactly how they are. So how are we going to frame the world? How are we going to look at the world? We're going to look at it as the silver lining. We're going to take the most positive view and we're going to bring that into reality on purpose, rather than let all of our catastrophizing and doubts and everything bully us into that negative reality. So our task really is to notice what's going on and catch it before we start ruminating on it, going over and over and over and over until it becomes activities of covetousness, maliciousness, or confusion, wrong views, that we get really stuck in the mud. No, it's like this. So, again, it comes back to being able to recognize what is going on in my mind, have the courage to see it, because then we can do something about it. Dare I ask questions, comments?
Hi, this is Courtney. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for tonight. It's really, really interesting. I was going to say something before, but I got cut off. But, just with the ill wishing, I think that's, like, really interesting. Yeah, I was thinking to flip it around as well, to not, like, wish, like, bad upon yourself or have conflict with yourself and do harm to yourself as well, because I think sometimes I struggle with really unhelpful things that harm myself too. So
that's right. So you can have a lot of ill will towards yourself, and it's exactly the same mechanism that's going on. So one, and Delma mentioned this at the beginning about blaming. So one, we might we come across things that we don't like, you know, they're difficult. It's a really difficult situation, or we don't know what to do. You know, everything, it's very, very tight. And so often ill will, we'll blame the situation and then we will seek to retaliate.
Yeah. Yeah.
With self-harm, what happens? We still blame, but instead of blaming out there, we blame us. And that's equally wrong. So because when we blame ourselves, what are we blaming?
We're blaming ourselves. I don't know.
Well, normally we're not blaming our, you know, if I go, oh, it was my fault, we're saying, oh, it's my fault, I'm bad, you know, I'm terrible, I'm not worth anything, I deserve all the bad things that happened to me. You know,
yeah, so we're not we're not saying the action's bad. We're like saying we're bad.
So if we're going to blame ourselves, we should say, I blame my maliciousness. I blame my ill will. My ill will is a big bully. But we don't do that, do we? We blame me. And when we say me, actually what we're pointing at is little me trying to be a good human being, vulnerable, wandering around all confused, like, you know, help me. That's the one we're blaming, the wrong one.
Yeah, definitely.
So the blame is really, it's very destructive, isn't it? And blame is a form of ill will.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's two things we can do here, Courtney. One is if you're going to blame, if you've got the momentum of blame and you have this thought, oh, it's me, it's all on me, it's all my fault, you've got to go, which me? It's the disturbing emotions. It's the afflictive states of mind that I'm going to blame. It's the inner bullies. Don't blame the good you.
Okay. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Really important, because just like we have conflict out there within, it's like we can be in civil war. And I remember for years and years and years, I felt like I had civil war inside me. Everything in me was in conflict and nasty, not encouraging. And so then, of course, all the words that I heard from others were nasty. I couldn't hear any encouragement because of what was going on inside. So that ill will, that momentum, at least it's not going out there. At least it's not presenting like, pointing the finger at the other. So, Courtney, at least that's harm minimization for the rest of the world, but it's not enough. You can't just keep pointing it at yourself either. You've got to point it at yourself and then at the disturbing emotions.
Yes, that's a good way to channel it, definitely.
So thank you very much for bringing that up, because really it's a big important point. Okay, anybody else? Anyone? To change our behavior, we must start with our mind. And that is somewhere that we can start, because we may not be able to control anyone or anything else, but we can start to live well within ourselves. All of the destructive habits of the mind, the three worst ones, covetousness, ill will, and distorted views. So trying to avoid them, remember it's not a thou shalt not. It's these road signs that keep us safe. So we are barreling through life under the sway of our disturbing emotions, our emotional baggage, our hopes and our fears. So at least if we've got this list of things, what to do and what to avoid, really basic, that will keep us safe as we're going through. It will definitely minimize the harm, and we may actually end up really good drivers. We may actually be able to then, you know, take others along with us. If we manage to just kind of try and tame our mind like this, we're going to naturally be happier. It's just a natural result. In fact, we can't stop that happiness. It'll just arise. And notice all of those emotional sensations, but don't believe them. Notice that the thoughts, the stories, especially those really denigration ones in your own mind, notice them, but don't believe them. So the homework, if you've got the notes, there is a worksheet. There's one set of questions there, overcoming harmful mental attitudes. There's just a few questions. There's only like one or two lines to fill in for each one. So very short, just dot points, just first thought, best thought, put them down. And there is the meditation there, a worksheet on the four opponent powers to do with the mind, to fill in and then do the meditation. And we didn't get a chance to do the meditation tonight. So what I'd like you to try and do with the worksheet is to fill it in. So the worksheet here, it's to get you going with the purification. And so, for instance, for covetousness or craving at the top, it's give some examples. So something that I'm coveting, you know, someone's nice pair of shoes. There's all the antidotes, they're there already listed. Then what I will do? Well, what I will do will be give all my good shoes that I don't wear anymore to the op shop, to charity. Who I'll do it for? Everybody else that covets really good shoes. What I won't do? I won't buy any new shoes for the next month. 1 month, I can do that. So what I won't do, and length of time, okay, 1 month, and then I'm going to put the date in. So what are we, February, so March 22. No more new shoes till March 22. So fill it in. So you do one for covetousness, one for ill will, or one for wrong views. It's a lot of fun, actually. And I always bring up the shoes one because I love shoes. I covet shoes. And here I am in a Buddhist center where you come in and you take your shoes off. It's so embarrassing.
Hello?
Vicky, yes.
I haven't been able to get the notes.
Ah, so can you just email Lungri Tumpa Center and I can get them to you?
Cool. I emailed last week.
Oh, did you?
I'll do it again. Yeah, no, that's okay. I'll do
I'm very behind this week. So please, Vicky, just flick me an email and I'll get them to you straight away.
Cool. Thanks.
Okay. So, and then next week we're going to look at speech. So the checklist for the speech and looking at our subtle internal dialogue. So how to tame our speech, what to avoid, what to do, but also looking at that internal conversation that goes on. So let's dedicate our merits. So what that means, all of the efforts of tonight, you know, these are intended actions that we've been doing. We've come along, we've concentrated, we've put our mind onto quite challenging topics. So all of that is creating a good positive mental habit of putting in effort where it really counts, where it's important to us and to others. So appreciate your efforts, and not just for you know, putting in the time now, but this is an investment for yourself, for your own long-term peace and happiness. But it's also an investment for humanity, because if you become a happier, calmer human being, it's going to affect the world in a really good way, in a positive way. It's going to make a huge difference to everybody that you come into contact day to day. So we dedicate for that, you know, may that really come to fruition. And more than that, may that momentum continue, so that we can continue to develop our good qualities, continue to spread peace and calm and compassion and kindness around us, so that eventually it permeates the whole world. We can bring everyone to that state.